Just a couple of reflections before we get going this morning. First of all, I heard all of you singing the last song, and you just sounded beautiful. So thank you. That was just incredible. The second thing happened at early church this morning. I was in the middle of my sermon, and the electrical system went out. Just completely went out. Everything went dead. And the first thing that occurred to me is almost every great sermon in the history of the world was preached without a sound system. Jesus never had a sound system. Peter, Paul, Luther, Wesley. So I thought, we just need to keep going. This may be the best thing I've ever done. And so I am so glad that you're here today. I'm glad you came out in the rain. And I believe that when we give a little extra effort to be in church, we're in a little bit better position than usual to receive something wonderful from the Lord. So if you're looking to receive something from God today, and those of you that are joining us on Facebook Live, this is a good day to receive. In this Go in the Gospel series, we've been examining the parables of Jesus. Every parable that we have explored offers a unique insight into the kingdom of God. The first thing I want to tell you is that parables were intended to be inertia breakers, the irresistible force that takes souls at rest and sets them into motion. They are far more shocking stories of spiritual disruptions than they are moral plays. The parable today is a good example. It's the parable of the talents. Most of us that grew up in church have heard it a million times. But what really kind of throws us off is talent. And talent in the Greek just is a unit of weight, like a pound or a kilogram. But because the word talent connects us to talents we may have, a lot of times people interpret this parable as a moral play. So the idea is, if you're a really excellent whistler, you should whistle for Jesus. That's all fine and well, and I'm not saying you shouldn't, possibly. But what I really want to say is, I think the story here is about spiritual disruption, not a little invitation to use our gifts for the Lord. When Jesus is doing parables, he is trying to shake loose the way we think and the way we experience and censor our lives. So let's lean into that radical nature of these parables. So today we're going to learn there's nothing more threatening to the kingdom of heaven than an object at rest. And we're going to discover why the single most risky thing you can do in your Christian life is nothing. Jesus was a teacher in a culture where people learned orally. Faith came by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. Jesus traveled constantly, and in his 3 years of ministry, it's not far off to think of him as like a traveling band. Traveling bands go from place to place. They play big venues. They play small venues. They may play indoors. They may play outdoors. But they do pretty much the same content everywhere they go. They move and they go to new places. That's very much what Jesus did. However, Jesus used a lot of different ways to teach. When I preach to you, I'm going to do it in a fairly similar way from week to week because, hey, I'm only talking for 25 minutes. But Jesus is going to be teaching all day. So if I was going to teach 8 hours, I would vary my teaching techniques. And one of the teaching techniques that Jesus used was parables. When he dealt with moral plays, he normally just was very straightforward about it. But when he talked about really complex things, things that are hard to get our heads around, he would tend to use parables. So if Jesus is using parables, he's getting at something really complex. Parables are simple stories told to simple people to reveal astounding things. I love stories. If you know me personally at all, you know I love stories. I love telling stories. I like writing stories. I like reading stories. I like hearing stories. I like songs that tell stories. I love stories. My 3 books were all collections of stories. And my introduction to my latest book talks about the power and nature of story. I wrote this in the introduction. It's very brief. This book is plain and simple, a collection of stories. Stories are to the human experience what songs are to an album or content is to a publication. Stories are the stuff that comprise our lives. Stories offer our lives context and color. They help us remember. They infuse meaning. And they convey the pain and exhilaration found in the seemingly unremarkable act of day-to-day living. Stories are containers into which we pour our lives. Stories allow us to savor memories, mark time, and measure growth. Stories are sacred and holy things. They're both birthed from and unfettered by time and space. Through story, we can go places we've never gone, experience things we've never experienced, meet people we've never met, and learn things we've never learned. If my stories help connect you to your stories, or better yet, to the ultimate story, then this short book will have been a noble enterprise. Jesus' stories were always about connecting people with God. I was taught preaching along with my friend David Huff down at Emory University by the late Dr. Fred Craddock. He was the foremost preaching professor of his era. He was the guy that wrote the books that all the other preaching professors taught from. I chose Emory University simply because Dr. Craddock was there and I wanted to be a pulpit preacher. So I wanted to learn from the very best. Raised in the Appalachian Mountains and steeped in storytelling tradition, Dr. Craddock was simply brilliant. He would often begin a class, and the whole class would simply be the telling of one story. He was so enthralling. In 2 minutes, he just swept you up. And he would spend 45 minutes telling a story, and you would swear you'd only been there for 3 minutes. But his brilliance was really in his last line. He would tell a story, and it was marvelous, but you couldn't think for the life of you what it had to do with anything. He may be talking about trains or a restaurant, and you're sitting there thinking, what's this have to do with anything other than it's awesome? And then in the last sentence, the last thought, he would somehow spin it in such a way that it absolutely set our hearts and our heads in motion. Dr. Craddock would often walk out, and we would all be sitting there speechless with our minds trying to process what we had just experienced. Dr. Craddock said that we needed to trust the listener when we preached. He said, you all are really smart. You'll put the pieces and the applications together on your own. My job is to build suspense, to tell the story, to place it in context, resolve the suspense, and then let you figure out what and how it applies after I'm done. Craddock used to say, don't tell them everything. Give them something to chew on. Don't flood them. Dam up the river and just let the water flow around the edges of the dam. They'll know how much you're holding back. There was always more to a Craddock story than a story. And his stories were always about the kingdom of heaven, every single one of them. When you look at the parables of Jesus, the kingdom of heaven is the subject of all of the parables and the sum of all of the parables. Last week we explored the parables of the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price. Both men, one stumbles on it, the other's looking, but they happen upon something that has the capacity to change their lives, and they sell everything to obtain it. Jesus clearly demonstrates the kingdom of heaven belongs to the risk takers, to the ones who are willing to sacrifice all to obtain something more and greater than they ever imagined. Today's parable is, it both continues that theme and intensifies it. Because not only are the risk takers rewarded in today's parable, but those who are too fearful to risk are cast out. In the first century in Israel, much of the wealth was controlled by wealthy landowners. When the Romans took over Israel, they just took a lot of the land and they gave it to Romans as rewards for being in the favor of the emperor. A lot of these lands produced wealth, and a lot of the landowners didn't live in Israel. So they would be in Israel for a while, but they were absentee most of the time. A lot of Jesus' stories are about this reality. Now, they would leave servants in charge of their holdings. It was expected that the servants would serve the master and have the best interest of the master in their heart. That was how this worked. This parable depicts something really, really common. A master leaves for an undetermined amount of time. He's almost certainly going to jump on the Mediterranean Sea, probably up in Caesarea, and he is going to head somewhere, probably to his home, and he says, I'll come back sometime, and I'll get an accounting of what has happened. Now, Roman roads were pretty good. In fact, there's still Roman roads in existence today. Mediterranean shipping was still dicey, but it was no longer the risk that it was in previous centuries at the time of Christ. So wealthy people traveled. They could travel with reasonable expectation that they would return home alive. This guy is leaving. There's no mention of when he's going to return. Here's the story. Verse 14, the kingdom of heaven is like a man going on a trip and leaving money with his servants to invest while he is gone. Dr. Craddock taught us that the first thing you need to do in a Jesus story is decide where you are in the story. Who do you relate to? Nobody in Jesus' audience is going to relate to the master. Nobody. The people who followed Jesus were not the enfranchised. They were the disenfranchised. So nobody's going to relate to the master. Now, there's three servants. The people in Jesus' audience are going to relate to the least of the three servants. That is who they are going to connect with. So from their point of view, whatever this story is about, it's not about the master. It's not about servant number one. It's not even about servant number two. They are rooting for, they are connected to servant number three, the least of the servants. That is where they are leaning. The imperative is really simple. The master entrusts all servants with money. And he says, while I'm gone, you invest it, you grow it. When I get back, there will be an accounting. So, once again, from the point of view of Jesus' audience, what happens to the servants is the point of the parable, not what happens to the master. Verse 15, he gave them each money in proportion to their abilities. So the three servants are given amounts of money based on their previous track record with the master. They do not all get even amounts. Those previously successful in smaller dealings were entrusted with more. Those who were unproven are entrusted with less. There's absolutely no historical agreement about how much money is being distributed here. It just says one got five bags, one got two bags, one got one bag. But we do know that a talent is a unit of measure. Most historians agree that a talent is a weight that weighs about 75 pounds. That's a pretty heavy weight. If you've got a 75-pound dumbbell, that's a pretty formidable amount of weight. And they were given a talent of gold constitutes one bag. So what I did is I took the present price of an ounce of gold, and I did my multiplication to kind of come up with how much money a talent would be in today's world. At today's prices, 75 pounds of gold is worth $1.8 million. So is everybody with me? Even the person that got one bag of gold got a whole lot of money. The guy that got two bags of gold got $3.6 million, and the guy who got five bags of gold could have paid off the entire debt of Christ Church. There's no way to precisely compare money values and buying power from one civilization to another, but I think it's safe for all of us to assume all of the servants got a whole lot of money. Is everybody with me? They were all entrusted with a great deal of money. It's not their money. Whose money is it? It's the master's money. Their job is to invest it. Verse 16 and 17. The two servants who were given the most money doubled it. They doubled it. So how would you make money in the Roman Empire? I sit and think about this because I'm boring. So here's how it all works. The Roman Empire is generally cash-strapped. In a cash-strapped society, if you have money, it's pretty easy to make money. Have you guys ever noticed that? You ever noticed if you have money, you're gonna get really good interest rates? If you don't have money, you're gonna get really bad interest rates. If you have money, it's easy to make money in a cash-strapped culture. So the easiest way to make money in Jesus' day was to simply invest it. You could roughly invest money and expect to get about 12% back a year in the Roman Empire, fairly safe. So that means if you had 6 years, you could double your money. Remember, the master was gonna be gone for how long? A long time. If he's gone 6 years and you just invest the money, boom, you've doubled your money. It's impressive, but it's not like he even had to have a whole lot of hustle. It just doubled. The second guy, he can invest his money, 6 years, boom, it doubles. Not bad. If you want to make more money and you don't want to risk it, money changing was the way to go. Those of you that travel a lot, you guys know when you travel, you've got two options. You can either get the official money changers and get a worse rate, or you can get money changed out on the street, get a whole lot better rate, but you're not exactly sure what you got going. Well, back in Jesus' day, money changers did exactly what they do today. So they take people who are coming in from different places and they turn their money into money they can use in that location. That was what money changers did. There was high profit in money changing. So what I really need you to know, it wasn't that hard. Wasn't that hard to make money in the Roman Empire if you had money. Riskier loans could definitely potentially earn you more. But just like today, you could lose part or all of your money, and it wasn't your money, it's the master's money. So, what we have is in the first two cases, they double the money. The master's confidence is rewarded. Both servants did what they were asked to do, outstanding. Verse 18, but the servant receiving the least, remember, this is who the people are going to connect with, but the servant receiving the least buried his money in the ground. Now, we learned last week, burying concentrated wealth was incredibly common. You just buried it in the ground. It was incredibly common. It's probably what this servant would have done with his own money. The problem is the servant wasn't instructed to protect the principal. He was instructed to make a profit. I assure you, the five bag of gold guy and the two bag of gold guy had once been one bag of gold guys. And what they saw as an opportunity to please the master, this guy was either too intimidated or just didn't care. But he takes the money and simply hides it. It's either overwhelming to him or it's uninteresting. Maybe he's just interested in other stuff. It's juxtaposed with the guys who sold everything to possess the kingdom with the hidden treasure and the pearl of great price last week. This guy is going to play it safe. He is not even investing the money at 12%. He's not money changing. He's not doing something risky. He thinks he is just playing it safe. These other guys, they seem to be out to win. This guy is playing not to lose. It seems like a safe play. Or is it? Verse 19, after a long time, the master returned. Transportation by ship, even in Jesus' day, is not a certainty. It's just not a certainty. And not only that, but if you were traveling, you had to carry your money with you. It wasn't like you had credit cards, and if you had them stolen, you could make a phone call and cancel them. Whatever money you had to carry with you. And so protecting what you had on you, not looking like you had a lot on you, was really a pretty good play when you were traveling. So occasionally people got robbed. Occasionally people got murdered. And occasionally ships actually did sink to the bottom of the Mediterranean. So there were bad things happening. So the longer a master was gone, people would begin to think, well, maybe they're not going to return. Because masters didn't always return when they left for a long time. So the master's been gone a long time, and now he returns. Boom! And it's judgment day. It's judgment day. It's the day of accounting. He has given his instructions. Now, boys, let's see what you got. Verse 20 through 23. The first two servants who doubled their master's money were praised and promised more to invest in the future, and they were invited to celebrate. Have you ever noticed at work when you're exceeding all of your goals and you know you're knocking it out of the park, you love evaluations? Right? You love them because something good's gonna happen. It's when you're not meeting your goals and things aren't going well that you dread evaluations. Well, the first two servants, they did exactly what was asked of them. And they did it really in spectacular fashion. They're excited that the master's returned. They're excited to see how they will be rewarded. So the effective servants are acknowledged. They're rewarded. They're praised. They're promised more responsibility in the future, which would be a promotion. But most of all, they're invited to celebrate with the master. They get to spend time with the master. That is the ultimate celebration. They have found favor in the eye of the master. Why? Because they did their jobs. They were asked to grow what was entrusted to them, and they did it. Well done, good and faithful servants. Heaven, then, is being where the master is. Heaven is dwelling with the master. Heaven is dining at the master's table. Verses 24 through 25. The final servant just returned the money. I don't know about you. Is anybody old enough to remember the old Newhart show? Not the Bob Newhart show, but the Newhart show with Larry Darrell and his other brother Darrell. Does anybody remember this? And Larry would always greet people. And he always gave them gifts, and it was usually roadkill, but it was in a burlap sack, and he would just kind of go here. And I could just kind of imagine the master shows up, and this servant has a burlap sack, and it weighs 75 pounds, and it smells like musty earth, and he goes, here's your money. Here's what you gave me. I didn't lose a cent of it. Well, there's no debate here that the master's a tough guy to work for. In fact, the master doesn't seem overly nurturing. His standards are really high. He expects results. And the one bag of gold guy was either intimidated by this or just simply didn't care. But he unilaterally redefined success from growing the master's money to preserving the principal. He thought it was a safe play. Now, a lot of people in Jesus' crowd were just ordinary folks, mind you. They probably had a lot of sympathy for this guy. This is what they would have done. They weren't movers and shakers either. They'd have no idea what to do with bagged gold. They'd have no idea how to invest it. The servant was honest about his intent. He's honest about his motives. He's honest about his action. He boldly spoke the truth about the master. There's no trace of malfeasance. He didn't lose a cent. No harm, no foul, right? And then Jesus throws the curveball that defines all of the parables. And this one just flat breaks in the dirt. Verse 26, the master replied, "You wicked and lazy servant." And the crowd would have had to be thinking, "What? Wicked and lazy? This guy's not wicked and lazy, he's just mediocre. He didn't lose the master anything, he just didn't make the master anything. He's playing it safe. He's waiting for the non-participants to be rewarded. This might have been his first try at business. He didn't lose a cent. Surely that's something to build on, right? Wrong. Verse 28, 29, take this guy's bag of gold and give it to the guy with 10 bags. Those who use what they have been given will be given more. The unfaithful will have what little they have taken away. Now, things have gone from a scolding to a straight-up corporate humiliation. His bag of gold is ceremoniously ripped from his hands in disgrace. And it's given to the guy that has 10 bags. He's the guy that least needs the opportunity. But he is the one the master most trusts to make him money off of that bag. But if you look at the parable, the rich are literally getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And regular people don't like narratives like that. The people had to be about to rise in protest. They had to say, this isn't fair. This is just all messed up. And then it gets worse. Verse 30, now throw the unfaithful servant out of the house and into the darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. Being thrown out of the house into the darkness, like being thrown into the burn pile in the parable of the wheat and the weeds, is normally a metaphor for hell. So the people had to be asking, Jesus, this is terrible. This is the worst story we've ever heard. What did this guy do to deserve this fate? And then Jesus tells his stunned and angry crowd, and the kingdom of heaven is like that. And the kingdom of heaven is like that. And they're all going. Everyone listening had to be sick to their stomachs. Being as the person in the story to whom they most related may or may not have been sentenced to eternal separation from the master. And just like here in a Fred Craddock story, Jesus offers nothing else in the way of explanation. He leaves a lot to the listeners, and they're just going to have to chew on this, just like we're having to chew on it after he was done. This is an upsetting and scandalous parable. It's not a moral play. It's not if you don't whistle for Jesus, you'll soon lose your ability to whistle. That's not what this is about. This has this scandalous undercurrent, and it drills down into our culturally shaped concepts of justice and injustice. Because for many people, this parable is chock full of injustices. We don't think the master should set such high expectations, but he does. We think everyone should get the same amount of money, but they don't. We think the servant who buried his money should be given another chance, but he isn't given one. We think the money should be redistributed equally among the other two servants or give someone new a chance, but that's not what happens. You see, we come away somewhat insulted that our sensibilities don't seem to matter at all to the master, and then it hits us. These are precisely the sensibilities that Jesus is relentlessly attacking. We don't get to decide what is just and what is unjust. God decides that. This is a public service announcement, not a topic for discussion. And the master is not asking for our approval or our endorsement. Let's face it, nothing more damages the fragile ego of our modern anthrocentric theological construct more than that, does it? It's precisely what modern theology fails to understand. The true gospel is about the master, not the servants. It's about God and what God is doing, and we are here to serve God. God is not here to serve us. Kingdom of heaven, like the hidden treasure and the great pearl from last week or the bags of gold from today, is offered to each of us, but we have to possess it. We may know it's there, but it's not ours until we possess it. We feel for the final servant, and we want to defend him. We want to defend him, and we want to say, he didn't do anything. He didn't steal the money. He didn't lie to the master. He didn't misappropriate the funds. He just played it safe. And yet the master calls him wicked and lazy, and he's thrown into the street. But Jesus is teaching us that doing nothing with the gospel is the most dangerous play of all. The gospel of Jesus Christ must be received. We don't get it by osmosis. We get it by acting upon it. So let me offer four thoughts about acting on the gospel. You remember last week, the guy finds a hidden treasure, but he has to sell everything he has to obtain it. The guy finds the pearl of great price, but he has to sell everything he has to obtain it. The two servants today who were successful are given the gold, but they have to interact with it. They have to invest it to make a profit. So let's take a look at how we act upon the gospel. Number one, we have to hear the gospel. What is the gospel of Jesus Christ? What is the gospel? We have to hear that for ourselves. And 1 Corinthians 15 is so clear about the gospel. Because 1 Corinthians 15 says, this is the gospel. Jesus died for our sins. He willingly gave his life at Calvary. He was dead. He was buried, and the third day he rose from the dead, and there are witnesses to it, and we believe the Bible is accurate testimony of the gospel of Jesus Christ. You got to hear it, but the second thing we got to do is we got to believe it. I hear all kinds of stuff I don't believe. I read all kinds of stuff I don't believe, but we have to believe the gospel. When Jesus asks, what do we have to do to inherit the kingdom? He says over and over, you got to believe this. You got to believe this stuff. And number three, you got to receive it. You see, I can know all about a hidden treasure, and I can believe that it's in front of me, but it's not mine until I receive it, until I take possession of it. And then number four, we have to engage the gospel. It's not about a one-time act of receiving the gospel. It's about giving our all to live in the dynamics of how the gospel changes and transforms our life, both in this world and for eternity. Have you engaged the gospel? Have you invited Christ into your life? Are you giving of yourself so that this gospel may be lived in you? You may have heard about it. You may even believe that it's true. But have you received it? And if you have, are you engaging it? We're going to close with just an old-fashioned altar call. And I'm going to invite the worship team in. We got two things we're going to do. Next week, we've got the impact commitments. And you say, well, churches always want money. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, we're wanting you to invite someone you know to Jesus. You know that little skit about jumping out of the airplane is kind of silly. But in a sense, that's kind of how life is. We are given the opportunities in our lifetime, of our lifetime, to receive and engage the message, the gospel of Christ. When we jump out of that airplane, we're sort of born, and at some point, we're all going to hit the ground. I'm sorry if you heard it here first. And I don't know about you, I feel closer to the ground than I did a couple decades ago. But we have this time called life to respond to the gospel of Christ and to engage the gospel. So one thing we want you to do is we want you to begin praying for people you know and love and care about who don't know Jesus. And we would just like for you to kind of get their names in your heart and just begin even right now praying. And so when we do this song, we're going to open this part of the altar area. You can kneel on the steps or you can just stand up there. It's getting harder and harder for me to kneel on the steps, I've noticed. But you can come up here and just pray for people that God puts on your heart. But maybe you've never asked Jesus into your life. Maybe you've never made that decision to ask Christ into your life. You know the gospel, you believe it, but you've not received it. If that's you, we would like to ask you to come on this side. And we would love to have somebody to come and pray with you to receive Christ. We had somebody come up in our first worship service, and we praise God for that because that's what churches ought to be doing. We ought to be leading people to Jesus. So I'm going to ask you to stand. I'm going to ask you to engage. I'm going to ask you to respond to this great gospel of Jesus Christ. Would you stand as we pray and as we praise together?